We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are looking at Gerry Anderson's UFO episode number something entitled Destruction. Do the numbers really matter?
Well, at this point, I don't think they really do because, as we discussed last time,
they're all over the place.
Yeah, they're all out of order, so who really cares?
And it's not like there seems to be a story arc, although, you know, after last time with the cat and
that's true.
Stuff, so it could be some big changes. A naval vessel is approached by a UFO, but they destroy it. The story hits the papers, but is rapidly covered up without Shadow's involvement. Straker suspects the Navy is up to something, and the UFOs are interested in whatever it is. He also suspects that they've developed a way to bypass Earth's defenses. Straker sends Foster to the Admiralty, where his job is to use his manly charms to get information from the female staff. He settles on Miss Bosenkay, the Admiral's secretary. Meanwhile, Colonel Lake takes Skydiver on a dangerous mission to try to locate the destroyed UFO in extremely deep water. The water is at least 1,000 fathoms deep, and they cannot find any of the wreckage. Straker, also undercover, interviews the Admiral, but gets nothing more than confirmation of his hunch that the Admiral is hiding something big. Miss Bosenkay turns out to be in control of the aliens and sends a signal to them, revealing a coded message from the ship. The ship is disposing of the most dangerous nerve gas ever developed by man by dumping it in the extremely deep water. If it were to escape, all life on Earth would be destroyed. The UFOs do have a way through the Earth's defenses, and one of them makes it through to attack the ship. Sky One arrives in the nick of time and saves the day. Life on Earth is safe again. Well, how'd this episode grab you?
No, not too badly, I suppose. I've seen worse.
Like that one by the Sound of Silence a while.
Oh, God, yeah. Definitely better than that.
I thought this episode was... Well, I think this one suffered from the filler syndrome, too. An awful lot of scenes of people just sort of doing things, talking about things. And I mean, did we really need for Straker to take Foster golfing to
that explain was a little assignment? Yeah, that was rather unusual. I couldn't quite figure out what the whole purpose of that was.
And we have the whole thing with Henderson over at Shadow headquarters having breakfast and having a conversation. And
breakfast, no less.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that was, I mean, we've seen this adversarial relationship between Henderson and Straker for all this time. And things aren't really starting off all that chummy right from the get-go. And before you know it, Straker is offering Henderson some breakfast, which basically consists of nothing more than coffee.
Yeah.
Or some toast.
Yeah, coffee and some toast. So let's have breakfast and it's coffee. Yeah, that was a little bit weird. But it's more of a... It's more of a courtesy, but I have to say this is one scene that did interest me because the general begrudgingly pays Straker some respect in it. You know, Straker says he thinks the UFOs have found a way through, and Henderson says, well, you know, not, they haven't been through in a long time. And then there's this sort of grudging sort of, not since you increased
the security.
The defenses.
Defenses, yeah.
And there's, you know, there's no doubt about it. That is a compliment that Henderson is paying him kind of through gritted teeth. You know, fought you all the way and this, but it seems to be working. And Straker just turns right around and says, yeah, well, that's not going to last.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and one other interesting line in that entire exchange, at one point, Straker says, to Henderson, are you warning me off? And Henderson says, no, I'm not warning you off, even if it sounds like I am. You know, and he still delivers with that really angry, very I don't know how quite to describe it, but it's an almost hostile tone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then while they're eating, Straker suggests, you know, do you mind if I continue with my own investigation? And Henderson, without missing a beat, oh, by all means, please do. Just don't expect any cooperation from the Navy.
Right.
But the fact that he seemed more than willing to support Straker in his decision to continue his own investigation, I thought really speaks of some kind of mutual respect.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think he is at the point where he can't deny that Shadow works.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah, he clearly has some personal issues with Straker. And that whole scene is weird too. Like, they just come in and talk about this newspaper thing, and it sounds like I'm warning you off, but I'm not warning you off. But can I go ahead and investigate? Sure, why not? Don't worry about it. It could have been accomplished so much. Many of the scenes in this episode could have been accomplished in so much quicker form. Colonel Lake's investigation of the
wreckage, or the
lack of the wreckage. I mean, she pushes the sub far beyond its safety limit.
Yeah, there was really no reason to stretch that. And apparently also there's some malfunction with the turbines. And for the longest time, Skydiver can't actually level out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still going down. And there's no really good reason why we had to have all that. I mean, just acknowledge the fact that, yes, it went beyond or went deeper than what Skydiver was capable of reaching, and just leave it at that. I mean, mm-hmm. This whole thing about, no, we're going to push it. Okay, we're pushing it too far. Oh, dear, we can't get out. I mean, that was an additional 3 or 4 minutes that really wasn't necessary.
Yeah, it was a lot of shots of people sort of looking nervously at the hull, as you do in those deep submarine movies.
Yeah.
So, Colonel Lake is cool as a cucumber, isn't she?
She certainly came off that way, but you could see that she was, when the turbines were finally beginning to work again and they started to level off, she's like, yeah, okay, level off. You could see the tension just kind of melt off of her for that moment when she realized, okay, we can get out of this. But yeah, she was pretty icy for the duration of that.
Yeah. But it speaks a lot to the crew that, I mean, they took it down, what?
Almost
300 fathoms lower than their safety depth?
I don't know what the fathoms to feet correspond to.
Is 6 foot.
Is it 6 feet? Because I think they went down, was it 900?
I think they went down 900 fathoms. No, they went down 800 fathoms because they had 200, at least 200 more below them. And so they were estimating it at 1,000 fathoms, which is deep. That's well over a mile. Way down. So that's one of the major ocean trenches there.
Mm-hmm.
They were really, you know, what would they have done if they had found evidence of the wreckage? I'm not sure what that was for, you know, other than just to kill.
Well, to verify, maybe.
And maybe just say, yep, we found it. Okay, good. He got it.
I think that's what it might have been, because there was, as far as Shadow goes, all they have is the naval report, and they had dismissed it for probably security reasons or PR reasons. I dare say the captain of the naval ship would argue otherwise, and he would say, oh, no, there was something there. But for the nature of this top secret operation, they're going to go ahead and say, oh, no, there was nothing there. Everything's cool. We're, you know, business is normal. And I think it was that denial which had Straker sort of concerned, and that's why he wanted to conduct his own investigation and prove the fact that, yeah, the UFOs, not only was there wreckage, but that they could actually sneak past
the defenses
around Moonbase.
All right, well, let's go right to the big one, and then we'll come back to some of these little niggly things. What is the purpose of the aliens coming to Earth in this series?
Well, in this series, as we have been led to believe, it is to harvest people.
And that's going to be really useful if they wipe out all life on Earth?
Well, I'm guessing, and I, you know, that was one of the questions that I had, but I think what they were looking at is, if life is exterminated by way of a nerve gas, perhaps it's possible that, you know, the parts could still be harvested, maybe fixed up a little bit. I mean, we've seen them do all sorts of really weird things, like blow up ships and hope to maybe salvage.
Get some kidneys here and there.
Yeah, a kidney here, an eyeball there, or something else.
Yeah, but that seems like a remarkable amount of waste. I mean, okay, let's say that they bring in a fleet of 1,000 UFOs and harvest bodies. Unless they can put the whole planet in some sort of stasis, you know, most of them are going to rot in fairly short order. Not the 1,000 that they collect, but in other words, they're not going to get a second 1,000. They're going to have wasted the entire population of the planet.
Well, this now sort
this
of begs...
is, you know, this seems more like a tactic of total war.
Well, this again begs the question. What is their real motive? Now, we know from the previous episode that Dr. Creepy has this theory that this whole harvesting thing is really not quite accurate because his autopsies seem to reveal that the UFO pilots, crew, whatever you want to call them, are entirely human. That there's not one shred of alien DNA or alien anatomy in there. They're completely human. They've just been configured, whatever, for whatever nefarious purposes the UFO aliens truly have. And this begs the question, you know, what we were asking last time. If this is indeed the case, then the idea of the harvest is now completely dismissed. The aliens clearly
have... Unless the harvest includes harvesting an entire animal.
Well, possibly. But there's more to it than that now.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a greater purpose.
But the other thing is, and this is the, like I say, this attack seems like total war. We cannot live with our, you know, we cannot exist as long as our enemy exists. So therefore, we must destroy him in total annihilation. But the fact is, Earth does not have the defenses or the forces to go after the alien homeworld.
No.
Even if we found it. So if the aliens stopped coming to Earth tomorrow, I don't think Shadow would chase them down. Maybe Straker would try to send a ship. But basically, the need for Shadow would go away. The Earth could stop worrying about it, and we could go back to peace. And I don't think we would go on the offensive.
No.
So it doesn't accomplish anything to kill everyone on Earth, except, well, they won't be blowing us up. Oh, wait, they wouldn't have blown us up if we weren't going to their planet anyway. Oh, yeah. The writer didn't know what he was doing.
Well, no, the entire thing does not entirely add up, which, again, if Jerry had a greater plan for this series, and maybe he really did have this idea, I'm going to start having my viewers think that the series is about this, and then at some point I'm going to do a left turn and make them think that it's something about, you know, this other thing, which is pretty bold. And rather, it's rather unusual considering when the series was made. I mean, those kind of arc left turns were just not the norm, if ever done. So for Jerry to, it's possible that Jerry maybe really did have that idea, and that this is just something that never had a chance to be fully developed because the series didn't go on long enough. And maybe and had there been more episodes, maybe we would have finally gotten some kind of answer regarding what is the actual motive.
Yeah, I suppose it's possible. I have to say, I think that's probably crediting Mr. Anderson.
I'm being very optimistic here.
Yeah, I mean, considering the time, he would have been a visionary years ahead of his time, and the fact is that you come back to his later shows like Space 1999 and Space Precinct, and we don't see any sign of that there, so I kind of...
Well, Space Precinct didn't have a chance to last long enough. I mean, it only lasted one season, and with 1999, well...
It got totally re-engineered.
I mean, the only arc, if there is one, is the fact that the moon is hurtling through space, and that's it.
It's arguable, but I mean, there is something that spans a couple of episodes that they come back to and go, whoa, you know, maybe I hadn't noticed that kind of thing, but we get to that some way. This episode was written by Dennis Spooner.
Yeah, that's a familiar name.
Uh-huh. He's a writer from Doctor Who and several other shows of that era, but he is the only, this is the only credit he has from UFO.
Hmm.
So he may not have been on board.
Well, also, we know, or at least we can theorize, based on the cast in this episode. I mean, we had this theory the last time we discussed it that there was a fire at the studio.
Mm-hmm.
The show went into a production hiatus. It came back, and there were some changes. Alec Freeman is gone. Now we have Colonel Lake. And right on at the very same time, there's this whole new thing about what the aliens are really all about. It's possible that maybe by this time, Dennis Spooner took a look at what was going on, and maybe he was even told, you know, this series, it doesn't look like we're going to get a green light for a second go. So we just have a few more episodes left, and everybody else is contracted. So we'll give you one story. Maybe that was it.
It could be. According to Wikipedia, Spooner befriended Gary and Sylvia in the 60s, and he would write for the Supercar, and then the scripts weren't used. He wrote for Fireball XL5, Stingray, and Thunderbirds.
Were any of those scripts used?
Yes, almost 20 of them.
Hmm.
He wrote one single episode of UFO and one of The Protectors. And he to write some additional scenes required to fit the first and 17th episodes of Space 1999 into a feature-length release.
Hmm.
So that's and he was actually a script editor on Doctor Who. I should have known that. From the Rescue to the Chase.
That far back.
Uh-huh. He is the guy whose job it was to replace all the major cast characters.
Oh, okay.
He was there overseeing changes and keeping the show alive during that time. So,
interesting. I mean, and considering that the cast also had some Doctor Who alum as well.
Well, Philip Madoc. Yeah.
Philip Madoc, as well as Edwin Richfield.
Admiral
Sheringham. Yeah.
He played an admiral, and I'm sure he played a military guy in Doctor Who. And
he played Captain Hart in The Sea Devils, and he was Mestor in The Twin Dilemma.
He was Mestor in Twin Dilemma?
Yep.
They put a real actor in there?
Hey, you're the one who recently saw it with Simon, not me. Well, I haven't watched that episode again in ages. I couldn't tell you that. I just looked it up on IMDb.
This is not fair, but typically speaking, when they hire people that they put in a costume like that, they're hiring them for a type, a physical type, like Michael Kilgariff to play the robot or Cybermen. They get big guys. They get physical guys. They don't hire. I mean, he's just a little kind of tiny guy with a, and it doesn't sound like him either. That's really a surprise. I mean, I know that guy. I mean, obviously you see him as in a military uniform. I think he wears it all the time, probably because I think everything I've ever seen him in.
He's always cast in military. I mean, like I said, when I was watching the episode yesterday, I kept thinking, wow, he looks oddly familiar. And I kept thinking he must have been in Doctor Who and he had to have played some kind of naval officer. And there he was, Captain Hart in The Sea Devils. I thought, okay, well, that's how I remember him.
Yeah, I've seen him in other things, but I couldn't tell you where. But you know, he's just got that look. That is what I expect British Navy officers to look like.
Yeah,
for the most part.
Yeah, he does have that air about him.
Okay, so yeah, so we don't know what's up with the aliens' motives here in this episode. Let's talk about Miss Bosun K, which is one of the most contrived names I've ever heard in my life. Bosun K?
It is a little pretentious.
So Paul Foster puts the hard moves on her. It's his hobby.
It's his hobby.
I know he said that.
Everybody has to have a hobby.
Yeah. And he goes to her place and she's got this, I mean, massive home telescope. I mean, that's the kind of telescope you see in an episode of The Avengers when you go to the eccentric British guy's house and he's got the the telescope in the full back roof in his house, kind of thing. And I don't know.
It's not an amateur telescope.
No.
Not by any means.
I mean, it has that look of the classic, you know, just a telescope, not with a reflective piece and or mechanics, but it's just so damn big for that style that you just look at it, and Foster doesn't seem that suspicious of it.
He doesn't come across as suspicious about it.
Yeah, look, you got a little telescope there, isn't that cute for a girl? Kind of thing.
Yeah, and then he asks, you know, are you serious? Oh, no, no, not at all. And then he asks her about this one star, and she rattles off, which was actually rather accurate, some constellation facts. And I thought, well, for somebody who's not very serious about her astronomy, she knows, she pretty much knows her stuff.
Yeah. And it wasn't quite like she was rattling it off in hypnosis, but it was close.
Close, but I could tell that she was pulling it from her own brain. I mean, that this was completely her under her own control.
Yeah, yeah,
it wasn't anything hypnotic.
I know, but it, you know.
But it did have this monotone kind of encyclopedia feel to it.
Right, right. And all that should have, I don't know, Foster should have been.
Well, that set up a red flag with me.
Right.
And it should have with him.
The telescope set up the red flag with me. You walk in that room and there's this telescope and you go, well, that's either the prop department just couldn't get that out of the room, or that's an important plot point. And if it's an important plot point, then she must be involved with one of the sides in this battle, and it can only be the aliens, so she must be in on it. That was like the red flag to me. It's like, she's the alien, or whatever, the alien spy.
Under their control. Where have we seen that before?
And yet this didn't appear to be taken over by the alien.
Not entirely. Well, but there was one scene where her behavior was a little bizarre.
Oh, where she was
walking around in circles with this blank look on her face.
Mm-hmm.
And then she finally comes out of it, and then she realizes, you know, the vase that she was holding that had water and flowers in it is now just fallen on the floor and broken. And
then that other woman who we
never
saw. Yeah,
other woman. Now, what was that? That was unusual. Now, there's something of a smoking gun. The fact that she comes in, and we've never seen her before, and for all intents and purposes, we'll never see her again.
And we don't hear what she says. They just like, oh, I ate flowers and dropped, and oh. You know, I mean, I think that's what the conversation appears to be.
Yeah.
That she's...
But why have this other person walk into the room? I mean, it's not really necessary to bring in an extra
cutscene
for the sake of the filming. A cutscene, maybe. That's the only thing that I can think of.
You know, maybe she lives there with a roommate, and that's who that is.
Maybe, but I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. There was no indication of that when Paul was over there earlier and getting some noogie.
Well, if you see the boots out in the hallway, don't come in.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That was a little weird. And of course,
it is very strangely filmed. I had to keep asking myself, why are you filming this scene with an extra when she is completely 100% irrelevant to the scene? She's not needed in the slightest.
Nope. She just pops up there to make me go, what's going on?
Well, the only thing that I could think of is in order to give Stephanie Beecham, playing Bosun K, some kind of reaction on a more expressive level.
You have been studying the cast on this episode.
Well, I kept thinking, I recognized her, and then Stephanie Beecham, who would years later also have her time in a submarine in SeaQuest.
In first season?
First season only. She played Dr. Westphalen.
She didn't seem that old.
No. She could have been very, very young when she did this.
You know, but yeah, the actress playing Miss Bosun K here couldn't be 20.
Oh, at the most.
20. So,
yeah.
Which is utterly irrelevant, but there you go.
Yeah, it serves no purpose. Yeah, and so, of course, yeah, us talking about it serves just as much purpose as some of the scenes that were in this episode.
This is what this is. These are our scenes where we demonstrate. I loved the fact that they had the scene where Straker goes down and talks with the Admiral pretending to be an air safety officer.
With the Ministry of Aviation.
And gets nothing.
Nothing. I know. I thought that was rather unusual, given that he's...
complete waste of a scene.
Well, it was. And I kept wondering about that.
What could you do in the real world if you had the retcon that they have? I mean, later on, they take the Admiral...
Well, they take advantage of it,
They take him straight back to Shadow headquarters, show him the setup, prove to him that UFOs are real, get him to tell them their story, and... You know, when he's talking to Foster to the side, he's like, well, what about the Admiral? He says, well, if we survive the planet...
We'll retcon him.
Well, yeah. We'll just give him the amnesia drug and he'll forget all about it. And if we don't survive, what does it matter?
Yeah, so if you've got that, I figured you might want to take greater advantage of it than to go through all this subterfuge. And I had to keep kind of wondering. I mean, I don't have a full understanding or even a little understanding on the governmental hierarchy. I mean, I know titles and, you know, you prime minister, you have your, all the different ministries and things like that. Where they all line up on the totem pole is something of a mystery. And, you know, my first thought was, well, if Straker is masquerading as somebody from the Ministry of Aviation, I would kind of think that maybe the Admiral will be a bit more forthcoming, but if this is a super top secret thing, then maybe his orders come from somebody higher up the chain of command. I don't know.
Well, it'd be a different ministry altogether.
And I guess all the ministries don't talk to each other.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I assume that they're all under the Ministry of Defense, but the Admiralty is under the Ministry of Defense, so this aviation doesn't, I don't think, corresponds to anything real. But
well, it does kind of. Again, this also makes you kind of wonder, if you've got the retcon, why aren't you using it? Why does Straker seem reluctant to want to use that instead of trying to go for the subterfuge? And we see them do this all the time. I mean, Paul's doing it with Bosley.
Moral character?
I don't. Maybe.
You know, it's like, that's kind of a dirty trick to pull on people. We have demonstrated that even though Straker is the calculating computer that he is, he's also, most of the time, a moral individual.
True.
Although in that instance of the square triangle where he puts them back to the... he takes their memory out so that they go off and kill the husband, that one is a little less so.
Well, yeah. Little bit of ambiguity there. But you have to wonder what kind of moral ground you stand on if your primary method of investigation is going to involve lying as opposed to using the truth and then just wiping their memories. I mean, is it too dangerous?
Could
I mean, we really, we don't know anything
Maybe
about the record.
It's not 100% effective all the time.
It could be. And if that were the case...
Then they'd have to kill him.
Well, true. But... you could at least then throw that out there. I mean, we've seen, as we've discussed, not just in this episode, but in so many others, there's been a lot of unnecessary scenes, a lot of unnecessary dialogue. Well, here's one that I think could really benefit from some kind of further explanation. Well, why don't we use the retcon? Well, I'd prefer not to, and this is why. I will use it as a last resort, but I'd prefer to do it this way, and here is why. You know, you could sum that all up in 15 seconds, and then that will be your established canon from here on out.
But in the Sound of Silence, it seems like they're pushing that stuff pretty easily. Like, oh yeah, just bring the sister in here so that the brother gets 2.5 seconds of groggy vision of her face before we wipe all their memories. That seems like, well, that just seems like they had no qualms about using the amnesia drug. So, it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
Once again, inconsistency in the show from one episode to the next. Let's see what else we got anything in this. We didn't talk about the laser beam signaling device. Straker and Colonel Lake gets a lot to do in this episode. I mean, in a way. I mean, she commands a skydiver. She goes out there and nearly crushes a sub. She does a breaking and entry with Straker. Which I like that Straker's, you know, talking to Foster. He says, well, take her out to dinner tonight. Make it a nice place.
Make it a nice meal.
And as Faust is leaving, he's like, you might just leave me the key.
Leave me the key.
You know, like completely assuming that Paul Foster
has the key in the first place.
Yeah. I guess maybe Straker is very good at assessing the capabilities of his staff. And he must know that Foster never fails. You might as well just give me the key, love. Then I can come over anytime I want and practice my hobby.
Oh, God. I'm sure that happened probably, you know, if they'd had enough time, they probably would have written that in.
If they'd thought of it, they would have written it in.
Yeah.
Still, you know, when he pulls scenes like this, I look at that and I go, I can't picture him as somebody who is in the running to play James Bond.
No, he's not suave enough. He strikes me as somebody who thinks he's suave enough, but not really.
So, yeah, I mean, he got a role in Spy Who Loved Me, but
a little role.
Very little. And he was better in that. He seemed, in fact, I think they were trying to play a joke there so that you'd think that that was Bond in that scene.
Yes.
And in that one, it's relatively effective because at the time, I think when I saw it, I'm like, is that? Oh, no, it's not. Okay.
Yeah, it had me fooled for a few minutes or a few seconds as well.
So, anyway, so also Colonel Lake gets to do surveillance.
And not very well.
Yeah, she's looking away the one time when they're having a cup of tea, when there's something happening. It's nice that there was an abandoned building across the way that they could rent and dust a little hole in the window and look out through.
Yeah, I was more, I mean, that's just a hand wave. It's like, okay, whatever. But it was her turning away from observing Bozen K at all moments. I mean, when you have someone under surveillance, you have to have them under surveillance. You have to be watching them all the time. You just don't turn away unless you've got somebody else there doing the surveillance with you. And then you can kind of like, you know, each one turn away at a given moment or whatever. But if you're alone, you need to keep both eyes open on your subject all the time, especially if you suspect that that person is doing something really shady that might involve, oh, I don't know, maybe UFO aliens? Because you never have any idea when the slightest thing could just happen. You know, okay, I'm arranging some flowers here. I'm going to set them down and I'm going to pull out a communicator. I mean, granted, that's not exactly what happened, but you just can't assume that, you know, because your subject is holding a vase with flowers, that absolutely nothing is going on and nothing is going to go on for the next 3 minutes. It's irresponsible. Yeah. And I was very surprised that Colonel Lake did that.
When Straker and Lake break in, they take the marked coordinates off of that big telescope. And Straker gets a hunch and he positions an interceptor on permanent standby in space along those
coordinates.
Along those coordinates. And it practically takes the interceptor out with the laser transmitter beam.
But after she changes the settings on her telescope.
But she changed them to the marked settings, I think.
We don't know that.
I think that was meant to be the assumption. I mean, that's why you have marked settings on a telescope, is so that you can always return them to that same spot.
Possibly.
Although, you know, I believe, if I understand my astronomy correctly, the Earth turning as it does might actually cause that to be not
quite on
a
point.
Straight line that Straker could place an interceptor on.
No.
So another technical problem.
Slightly.
That may have manifested itself. But yeah, makes the pilot kind of go all drooly and unable to function, which also doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But really, the scene was there for just killing time. It's just killing time.
Yeah, I don't know what else I would have done with that, to be honest. I mean, it was a very strange scene.
Then we have a little bit of a scene later on where they determine that two of them did make it through, and you know, one of them is able to be destroyed, but the other one gets through. So now we know we have this major hole in Earth's defenses because they've been able to find a way past our detectors and past SID. And then at the end of the episode, Straker says, "Oh yeah, the boffins down in the lab have determined that all we have to use is use two frequency waves, and that problem will be fixed.
Yeah, so double up on the frequency waves, and that should fix the problem until the aliens learn to crack that.
But, it's like we needed a way to get them through this episode, and by the end of the episode, we need to make sure they don't have a way through Earth's defenses. So, it's really like a big reset button there by the end of the episode.
Yeah. So,
what else have we got? Anything?
Oh, yeah.
Bosun K's dad.
Oh, that's right. He's a kind of a key character.
Yeah, I mean, he's not in it, and he's dead, as far as we know.
But his presence is felt, shall we say.
Yeah, I'm not sure how, though. I mean, her dad worked on Moonbase, and then he died, or perhaps he was abducted by aliens.
That's kind of what Straker is theorizing, but so they go with the he died story.
But
either way,
she's controlled by the aliens, not being blackmailed by the aliens. So,
and the theory was that they got to her before Shadow was really fully, or at least before Moonbase was fully operational. How they managed to do that, we don't know. It's a lot of conjecture.
Yeah, and what does having her dad have to do with that? And
the
why
fact that
would
she,
they?
I don't know. Maybe the fact that she works for the Admiral. That's the only thing I could see.
And the Admiral being somebody that they've never had any interest in, as far as we can tell, until they are trying to release nerve gas under the ocean.
Mm.
Yeah, and it just seems like they just bring it up, and it's like, her dad, and he could be in the alien, and that it doesn't matter.
No, and it makes for a rather convoluted plot point.
Although I feel like the actor that they had the picture of that was supposed to be her dad looked awfully familiar.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out who that was supposed to be, but that's an actor that I've seen before.
Somebody, yeah.
Yeah, but I have no idea who. I want to go back to this method that the UFOs were using to get through.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's some kind of a jamming device, but what I thought was interesting is the inconsistency in its use.
Mm-hmm.
That there were moments where, other people were able to detect it through their monitoring systems, but Moonbase couldn't. And then also, it doesn't affect the Navy ship's radar.
Right, didn't affect radar.
So at first my thought was, maybe it's affecting Moonbase because of proximity, but when the UFO is in the Earth's atmosphere and it's making its approach, wow, the Navy radar, their ship radar picked it up right off the bat, and they were ready to defend themselves. So I thought, that's kind of,
Maybe they turned it off when they were past the interceptors.
Oh, God, stupid.
That wouldn't be the first time.
No, I suppose not. It just made the idea of them being able to cloak themselves to get past Moonbase a little cheap.
And why did the UFO fly towards the ship at the beginning of the episode?
That's a good question, because we were under the impression that the ship was merely looking for a place to dump this nerve gas.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't loaded with the nerve gas. It was just looking for a place to dump it. I don't know. Maybe the UFOs were simply trying to see if the Navy found a place.
Wouldn't they have gotten that information from Ms. Bosun K?
Exactly.
She said, hey, they found a place.
They found a place.
And here's the place.
And here's the place, and here are the coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
Because she actually sends them the coordinates through that laser communication. It's the same coordinates that the Admiral has.
Yep.
So what was the whole purpose?
Well, the ship sent the coordinates, coded, to the Admiral, which means that Ms. Bosun K got the message. Coded, took it to the Admiral. She gives the information to the aliens, which she herself hid within her own compact, because that's where she finds it when she takes it out after she's gone into her hypnotic trance. So presumably she stole the note, perhaps in a hypnotic trance, put it in the compact, closed it up, didn't realize it because she's now not in hypnotic trance. Then she goes home. They put her in another one. Then she takes it out. Then she transmits the coordinates, which then they have to decode because she didn't give them the decoded version. Yeah, not at all convoluted.
then again, why the heck does the UFO approach the Navy ship at the beginning of the episode? That's the big question. What was the whole purpose behind that? I mean, the Navy was not about – they did not have the nerve gas. They're just scouting.
As far as we know.
As far – well, I think it's pretty clear that that's what they were doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sure they were clearing – they were scouting a location. I'm just I don't think there's anything in the episode that proves one way or the other that they loaded the nerve gas after he came back and said, I found a place. Maybe he is floating around with that damn nerve gas on there.
Well, he goes back. Kind of dumb, we know that.
Right. Which, let's face it, that's a long...
It's a long haul.
That's a long haul, but it only took him a day.
Yes, and yeah, and that was one other little thing that kind of had me puzzled. It was at one point when they were getting ready to reach the location to dump the nerve gas, it was 2:30 in the morning, and the captain says it's going to be light in 30 minutes.
Yeah, he said it'll be light at 3.
3 in the morning?
He actually said it will be light at 3 a.m. He said that.
Yeah.
Not just 30 minutes. He said at 3 a.m.
Well, 3 a.m., yeah, but...
And then he told his number one to wake him up, and that was it. It woke him up at 2:30, yeah.
And I thought, okay, it's going to be light at 3 a.m. You must be near one of the polar regions.
They were in the South Pacific.
Yeah, they were in the South Pacific, so they had to have been near Antarctica.
They get no mountains, so you're going to get some light fairly early.
Yeah, but at 3 a.m.?
It's pretty early.
Yeah, that's pretty early.
It's pretty dark.
Yeah. And by the time 3 a.m. rolled around, it was pretty light outside. I'm really picking nits here. I admit that, but it was just one of those things that I thought, well, that just... I don't know. It stuck in my craw for some reason.
That's what craws are there for.
Yeah, to get things stuck in, like, bits of food between your teeth.
Or episodes of UFO.
Mm.
Don't quite make sense. In that case, I guess I'll call time on this discussion and invite our listeners to join us for the next time we talk about UFO, when we will be looking at, I believe, The Man Who Came Back.
I think I've seen that one before.
Ben, thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure always.
And listeners, we hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. If Colonel Lake was 20, I don't think anybody would buy off on it. I think she's 30 there, but which is still ridiculously young to be a colonel.
Yeah.
Man or woman, but Shadow is an equal opportunity hirer of people too young to be colonels, apparently.
For some odd reason, I don't know why, but given the hobby that Paul has and given the lecherous behavior or almost lecherous behavior we've seen with Alec Freeman, I honestly for a second thought you were going to say Shadow's an equal opportunity molester.
Well, if I were Colonel Lake, I would keep away from Colonel Foster. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, the way he made his moves on Bozengay.
I mean, she dodged Colonel Freeman in the pilot episode.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.